I'm still thinking about that ethical dilemma anyway. We could talk about this forever. But I just wanted to move on. Dr. Malice is going to talk to us about the resignation syndrome. And it's a very interesting topic. I was reading the New Yorker article that you passed on to us, Dr. Malice, which talks about, it was written in April this year, I think it was published, and it talks about Swedish refugee children. There were hundreds of them, from what I understand, who felt unconscious after being informed that their families were to be expelled from the country. And I guess this leads us on to a whole host of topics. In particular, you're going to describe the resignation syndrome and what that means, what it's all about.
Well, I was going to, but in light of what we've just talked about, I think the ethical questions that have been raised about evidence really is at the heart of this syndrome. And the, as you say, Lolly Doc, the article that was passed on to me along with a scholarly paper called Resignation Syndrome, Catatonia or Culture Bound, in a very reputable journal at the frontiers of neuroscience, raises some profound questions about medical ethics and how do we know what we know as so-called evidence. I just point to first the case that was written up in the New Yorker concerned a young boy called Giorgio, a Russian emigre, actually a refugee, who came with his mum and dad and a younger sibling to Sweden in 2007 when he was 5 years old. So now he's 15 at 2017. And the article covers the acute episode where he was had to be fed with a tube down his nose. It's called a nasogastric tube, because he actually went into this unknown state, whether it was catatonia, fugue, dissociation, it remains an open question.
And for our listeners, Dr. Malice, what are those states? What do they mean? What is catatonia?
Now, these are states that are very often associated with very severe mental illnesses or severe trauma, where the person's conscious state is lost. So basically, they are no longer communicative. That's the basis. Once you've got a non-communicative communicative person, then you make what's called differential diagnoses. You try to sort out, did they have a brain lesion, say a pressure on the brainstem or a stroke that left them in locked-in syndrome, as it's called, or various other losses of consciousness from brain injury, or the so-called functional illnesses, the most common one being a schizophrenic catatonia, where people actually go quite rigid and you can't do anything unless they get ECT treatment. Now, in between, there's a range of disorders called traumas, which have got altered states of consciousness that are going from mild to severe. At the mild end are mild partial dissociations. At the other end of the extreme is severe dissociation and indeed what are called fugue states, almost sleep-like. Now, what is at the heart of this problem is that this condition, this resignation syndrome, which affects hundreds of children in the last 15 years in Sweden, is only located to Sweden, which already is an extraordinary phenomenon in mental health. Why should it not be in the host country, say in the Russian provinces where these refugees came from, or other European countries, or indeed Australia, which have taken in the refugee children? Now, the turning point, at least in the New Yorker article, comes as I'll quote, in an open letter to the Swedish Minister of Migration, 42 psychiatrists asserted that the new restrictions on asylum seekers and the time it took the Migration Board to process their application, children could be in limbo for years because of this processing, were causing the disease. Now, 42 psychiatrists really is quite a body of expert opinion. So who would dare go against mainstream opinion saying this is a disease, firstly, let alone that it's caused by migration policy and determinations of deportation or not? Ethical question one. Ethical question two, the actual paper that is in a reputable referee journal, a very serious publication called The Frontiers of Behavioural Neuroscience, Resignation Syndrome, refereed paper with references. But if I look at the references, and if I was a referee for this journal, I would not pass this paper. Why not? it makes absolutely no references to some of the most recent developments in trauma-informed care. How can you actually go by a journal which is published in the last couple of years but makes no up-to-date references in relational trauma, dissociative attunement, intergenerational trauma, and complex PTSD, which is part of this young boy's condition? Finally, the ethical question is, you insert a nasogastric tube because you have to save the life, but there's no evidence this child got any sort of intervention of child psychiatric treatment that are known treatments for stress. So I really question the ethics of how do we propagate knowledge from scientific journals where the very foundation of that journal article is open to debate, and let alone claiming, as these authors have achieved, classifying a new disorder. This new disorder is actually now classified as resignation syndrome, and it is up to, presumably, Swedish psychiatrists to diagnose it lest they become, duty of care is lost if they don't. My question is, I, as a child psychiatrist in Melbourne in 2017, if I were confronted with a family like this, would I be forced to make this diagnosis, or am I entitled to follow my practice, which is endorsed by the Australasian College of Psychiatry, Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, and international bodies on recognising trauma and trauma-informed care? This is quite an ethical dilemma. Now, it harks back to the question that we raised before of what evidence do we claim is evidence? Now, Dr. Autonomy, I'd love to hear your views, because you mentioned some of the evidence on suicide rates, on major depression, on anxiety, but where is the data on trauma in such populations, which is known to be a precursor of all those conditions, suicide rate, depression and anxiety? If we overlook trauma in the history of these individuals, are we first causing harm by not properly diagnosing? So I'd love to hear the evidence on trauma, first of all.
Dr. Mellis, would you... as I was saying before with that evidence, the reason that the mental health is so bad is because of discrimination and exclusion.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you would class discrimination and exclusion as traumatic events.
Not only would I class it as such, but I would go a step further and ask, who is doing the discrimination and exclusion? And I would say it's us, the mental health profession. We are excluding trauma from our training, from our thinking, from our policy. And yes, we are providing arguably discriminatory mental health services by not including trauma-informed care. So I don't in any way blame any practitioner who's been trained in the last 20 years, but I have now an ethical obligation to raise this question of what is known in the medical profession as iatrogenic disease.
Can you just help me understand, Dr. Mellis, what would the difference be? If trauma is a precursor to these outcomes of depression, anxiety, increased suicidality, what's the change in the management if it's happened as a precursor versus you're seeing it more in its kind of outcome state?
Thank you very much, Ms. Medic. That is at the heart of the problem, that most of these conditions are what are called comorbid. They coexist. If we only diagnose depression, suicidality and anxiety, not thinking of the comorbidity with trauma, which has got a totally different approach in treatment, then we're going to find really poor response rates for the three that are comorbid. Now you ask, what are the treatments? Well-known and well-accepted treatments, EMDR, for example. It has had a very controversial beginning 20 years ago, but it is rapid eye movement desensitization process, now universally accepted as one of the beginning forms of treatment. But before you get into the technical parts of treatment, it's the attitude with which the clinician approaches the patient. That is, where there's a history in this resignation syndrome of migration, of duress, of fleeing a country, that at the age of five is going to be traumatic not only for the child, but for the mother and the father and the other sibling. And so it's an attitude of how does one even take a history? Does one straight away go into, oh, you've got depression, suicidal anxiety, and you had a migration, well, that's, you know, that was 10 years ago, so that doesn't matter. That's what child psychiatry and good medical practice, and you advocated for good medical practice, it's to understand our patients' lives. And just because it happened 10 years ago, 20, we've got ANZAC veterans, 90 years later, still having flashbacks. Is that good medicine to overlook trauma because it happened 90 years ago? No, it's not good medicine. Is it discriminatory? Yes, it is. No one's at fault. It's just the knowledge was not there. I can't use that excuse in our current culture of trauma-informed care.
You're listening to Radiotherapy 3RRR 5 to 11, talking with Dr. Autonomy Mismedic and Dr. Malice about the resignation syndrome and the ethics of ignoring precursors to ill health.
Can I just ask the question, Dr. Malice, how then do you engage someone who's in a near catatonic state with psychological treatments? Because
yes.
Often they are, from my understanding, fairly shut down from yes. a psychological point of view, yes. and the initial treatment is obviously to sustain their life,
yes.
hence the nasogastric tubes and those sorts of things. What do you do in that instance in order to start their actual treatment of trauma?
Absolutely. In this instant, as you quite rightly say, saving life is the priority. We talked about triage in the past. When there's a life-threatening condition, you treat it. However, there are other children who are actually well downstream, who are showing much milder conditions, which are the precursor to this well-known resignation syndrome. But if they're allowed to go unnoticed, then what is the ethics of that medical community as systemically really discriminating and overlooking medical facts? So I have no problems. When there's a life-threatening situation, you must do what they're doing. However, I do question labelling such children and awaiting for others to join the nasogastric tube, as in fact, one of the carers, Professor Holtz-Kruntz, who is really at the centre of this debate, she's an emeritus professor of ENT, and she, it's quoted, seems unaware of her power as she encourages families to, quote, get their tubes, meaning that already when their children are not quite well, she encourages mother and father to get the tubes ready. And there is a questionable ethics of why not intervene with proper trauma-informed care rather than advising get the tube.
This reminds me a little bit of our own local experience in Australia and our response to refugees and deportation and Nauru and the American swap solution and yes. all those sorts of things. I wonder, are we unethically joining in providing extra trauma to true refugees?
Now, these are tremendously different cultural questions and political questions and moral and ethical questions. However, as a profession, if our mandate for 2,000 years has been to first do no harm, then our first priority is to get our own house sorted out. And that is where there are conditions that we know are traumatic, and trauma is a precursor to suicide, depression, anxiety, and identity disorders, and so on. Our obligation is to follow the evidence of precursors put people at risk.
So let's sort out
our house. Yes.
Refugee solution. Let's sort out our marriage, no, marriage, yes, equality solutions so that we can reduce trauma for future generations.
Absolutely. Yes, prevention, and I was taught an ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure.
Wow. Who taught you that?
That was before they had computers. No, this was, we had hieroglyphics and we wrote on stone tablets.
I remember the 1800s. Yeah. how do you make an octopus laugh?
Tickle all its legs?
Tentacles.
Oh, well, close.
I can't believe we only had one dad joke in the whole hour.
Really? Have you seen the movie Constipation? It's not out yet.